This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research. Growing up just outside of Chicago during the Civil Rights era, Claude Steele was raised with an awareness of the importance of education for Black Americans. His interest in literature nearly led him to become a writer, but he found that social psychology was more to his liking. Steele's research has focused on the psychological need to maintain mental consistency, the role and origin of addiction, and the idea of self-image. His theory of stereotype threat, which describes how negative images of certain groups can affect those groups' intellectual performance, has been widely publicized. Elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2003, Steele is the Lucy Stern Professor of Psychology at Stanford University. Dr. Steele was interviewed by Dorian Devins in 2004.
When you were growing up, were there scientists in your family or adults who were scientists that got you interested in this?
No, I was raised in a working class family. My father was a truck driver. My mother was a social worker. And perhaps there's the connection to becoming a social psychologist. You know, it's hard to know those things for sure, but it was a family deeply interested in social issues, the civil rights movement. I'm an African American. I grew up in a time when that was very much on Americans' minds, the whole nature of race relations. It always is to some degree, but then it certainly was a very explicit part of American life. So those are the kind of influences that I grew up in. I grew up outside Chicago in Harvey, Illinois, Phoenix, Illinois is the actual name of the town.
I read a couple of articles by you, and you mentioned your father and his advice. It seems like he must have had a great influence on you as well, because that was sort of planting the idea of how to overcome the stereotypes that you're going to meet, particularly in education.
Well, that's true. He wasn't an educated man himself. He was born in 1900, and to the best we know, I think he was the child of slaves. So he didn't have opportunity to get an education. However, that didn't prevent him from giving advice. And most of it was very sage, but it was in the context of how to keep a job, which for African Americans was a major concern, because you didn't have the security that often others had in society at that time. Although I think this was quite a general problem, really, in American life for a long time, certainly the early and mid part of the 20th century. So from his standpoint, what he wanted to pass on to his children was the wisdom of how to find and hold a job. And so a lot of that, I think, did wind up translating into my life context, how to succeed in education and get education and prosper in education. At least some of the wisdoms translated very well. And also my mother had a master's degree in social work, so she was educated.
So early on, I guess you had at least a subconscious awareness, if there's such a thing, of self-affirmation and self-image and the importance it can have, either positive or negative, in how your education goes and then your life thereafter.
Yes. Sometime in early college, I got just feverishly interested in psychology, and it seemed to be an outlet for the kind of things that interested me. And social psychology seemed to be pitched at that level of analysis in the sciences, at a level that was just very attractive to me. I was a reader, an avid reader of novels, and I've heard it said by others that social psychology is you could be a novelist or you could be a social psychologist. And I think in many ways you're working from the same perspective when you do either of those activities, that you're looking at the individual and how they're interfacing with the social world. And this is all in retrospect as a description, but I think somewhere in college I fell into that niche and have been happy ever since with regard to knowing kind of what I wanted to do and really liking the science part of being scientific at that level of analysis. It's fun because, unlike many other sciences, it's the closest to the science of everyday life, of everyday social existence. And so people are kind of intrinsically interested in what you're doing. They know what you can describe to them without much trouble what you're doing, and they get very interested in it. So it's an enjoyable level at which to do science. difficult as it is, challenging as it is to do science well at that level sometimes.
What sorts of novels were you reading? Any writers that were particularly inspiring to you, or psychologists for that matter?
Novels, I read everything that I could manage. I would go to the department store and just buy novels off the rack. So some of them were like that, some of them were classics, some of them were, you know, whatever. I just read. Kenneth Clark is an African-American social psychologist. I saw him on television when I was a freshman in college, home for the summer. There were riots in New York, and he was giving commentary. And he had such an incisive perspective on what was happening. And what was happening was confusing to everybody, threatening and confusing at the same time. And he was so incisive. And I'd just taken my first psychology course, and there he was using psychology to explain this. And he was so articulate and somebody you wanted to model yourself after. And so I was definitely imprinted, as we say in psychology, on Kenneth Clark. I interestingly met him only once in my life, maybe 25 years later. But he had a huge influence in the sense of, you know, modeling how you could have these interests and these perspectives and function like a scientist. I also just love the beauty of being scientific about it.
It sounds like there's an element of good timing there, that he came along right when you had taken your psychology course. Perhaps if he hadn't, you might have taken a different course.
Yeah. If there had been maybe I would have been a writer. I love to write, and maybe I would have gone in that direction. But there's also just the excitement of doing research, which I'd never known before and never seen done before. But at college, I started reading about them and then started working I went to a small college, Hiram College. I had great advisors, Ralph Sabula, Ray Knight, George Morgan. These were people that were very, very influential, and I just immediately loved experiments, and I've loved them ever since. So you can take a question that fascinates you in everyday life about something that you're really concerned about, anything, and form it into an empirically testable question. And invariably, once you do that, you find out more about that than you ever imagined to be true. And so, you know, that's sort of the core excitement that I experience as a scientist, as a social scientist.
So it's almost as much about the scientific method that you enjoyed that as much as...
Absolutely, absolutely. The thrill of doing this research and finding out more than you thought and uncovering the depths of what seemed like of ordinary life. How much there is there, and if you know it, how much you can change it. And that whole process was just the sort of thing that resolved what I was going to do with my life right away, very early.
Do you remember what experiments you did early on when you were in college?
Yeah, I did things, some were in physiological psychology and some were in social. I did things, I can remember, you know, this is probably a juvenile hypothesis, but testing which motive was the strongest in a fish called beta splendens, Siamese fighting fish. And I would have a male go down a T-maze. And when he got to the choice point of which way he was going to go, he could look in either direction and see either an aggressively displaying male or a sexually displaying female. And it seemed like a great question to me, which was in the species that had been so selected for its aggression, which would be the strongest? And I never wound up answering that question. But the whole experience of putting together the experiment and doing it, you know, it was kind of a behavioral investment in the enterprise of doing science that I think had some consequences. I just enjoyed it. I loved it. And it didn't bother me that the experiment didn't tell much. And that was good training for the future, because a lot of experiments don't wind up telling you very much. It's hard to do good experiments. Other ones I did, completely other end of the kind of continuum of social psychology, did African-American dialect. Was that a symbol of identification that kids used in high school? Was the dialect preserved and used as a means of maintaining a kind of ethnic racial identity in school? That was a question. So that was done more as an interview study. But interestingly, some of the questions that came out of that project I did as a college junior or senior wind up reappearing in my research now, these 30 years later. So, you know, you have this basic set of questions, this perspective toward life, and it does reemerge in your work over the course of life.
it's a clue certainly to what your interests are.
Yeah.
Did right. you have a conclusion from that particular?
I did get a little better picture of things there, and I did have the sense that dialect was used, the degree to which it was a marker for how loyal you were being to your ethnic in-group. And of course, that's well known now and well documented in all kinds of research. But if you didn't use it in the in-group, you'd be rejected. I mean, it would be tantamount to announcing you didn't want to be part of the in-group. Because when you were with the group, you had to use the language that was appropriate. And it's difficult. The rub for people, the stress for people, is if their in-group was present and they used in interacting with out-group members, with the schools, teachers, other students and the like, more standard dialect, that would also problematize their identity with the in-group and so on. So it was very clearly the maintenance of that dialect, which people think of as having no social constraints at all, that people can just decide, well, which language are you going to speak? Shouldn't you try to improve your language and use more standard English all the time? Well, the hidden picture were the consequences, the social consequences, and the acceptance in the community that one would have to pay. Now, that was 35 years ago. Now, all that is known very well in the work of a number of social scientists, so it was the beginning of getting interested in those problems and, again, seeing the power of research to answer those problems.
You were before your time there.
Yeah.
I guess the feeling would be that the individual was in some way betraying the group by choosing the other dialect mm-hmm. over the... But there's also an opposite thing going on now, too, I think, where there's the sense of invasion by, you know, appropriating the mm-hmm. dialect. And mm-hmm. so I guess that's...
Yeah, still a very charged along. Issue in society is the use of these markers and who has the right to use them and so on. So you get phenomena like that where the use of it is policed. On the other side, the same phenomenon is a sort of acting white business where that's sort of offered as an explanation for why the in-group, and often the African-American in-group, is not achieving in school because they're so policed to use the dialect and those perspectives that success in the mainstream is seen as tantamount to walking away from one's own group. So the tensions around that issue, I think, are, you know, very central to American society, or to certainly the task of integrating American society.
There seems to be a lot of pressure put on kids to stick to their, I guess, what you could call racially oriented dialect.
Yeah, actually, the anthropologist who just died last summer, John Ogbu, in the mid-80s, I think, did an ethnography of an integrated high school in Stockton, California, and he coined the term acting white. And his observations were very similar to the observations I made when I was a senior in college in suburban Cleveland, in an integrated high school, and the use of dialect there. So that problem it turned out, after going in very many different directions, wind up being something that's very central in my own research.
That brings up the problem, I imagine, of doing this kind of research with a focus on race. It is so charged that it must be difficult with some experiments or just at certain periods of time to do these experiments.
Yes, yes. This is an area of science that isn't for the faint-hearted, I'm afraid. Because I've done science that was in charged areas and science that was not in charged areas. And one's life is a lot more peaceful when you're doing science in an area that's not so charged. I did research on self-concept and dissonance theory and self-affirmation theory as an alternative to that. Those are very theoretical issues that are central to basic processes in social psychology. I love that research as much as any research I love. And there's certainly conflict among the various theorists and the various camps, but nothing like the charge about that are like doing research in the area of race, where it's a topic that's of such central importance to American society that everybody has strong feelings about it from every side. And so it's difficult to say or do anything that doesn't have some tension to it at the very least. I've been pretty happy that a lot of our research has managed to be largely informative without being political and without being too responded to in political ways, and that I think we've informed the assumptive world of this discussion. And that's kind of one way that I and my students and colleagues try to think of ourselves, as informing the knowledge base that society has with which to think about these issues and policy with regard to these issues. And I think that's the basic mission of a scientist. I don't feel that I'm a pundit or somebody that can just talk about any issue in that topic domain. We're working on a very clear set of processes, social psychological processes, that we're trying to clarify and describe theoretically and demonstrate empirically. And it, you know, it's a long, tedious, well, it's actually a lot of fun to do the research, but it's a long road. What's tedious is just the normal things of science, publications and revisions and work, and you're getting money to do it all and those things, but the research itself is just absorbing, so that we can put the discussion on a more informed basis. So I think of us, I for the most part, there are exceptions. Sometimes it gets into the public and you get into the middle of a political debate and you get attacked, or somebody else uses you to attack somebody else and you're regretful about that. But I've learned there's not much you can do about that. So there is a difference, and that this is something that I was about to say, maybe social psychology is more likely to have that experience, but I'm not sure. I did research also for 14 years on addictive behaviors, alcohol addiction, and we developed the social psychological theory of alcohol addiction. That was something completely different. I had no personal interest in it. I just had an idea about it one day, and I was in a psych department where a lot of people did addictive behaviors research. I'd gone to seminars. I'd learned about it. I was on vacation. I read an article just thinking about that, and I thought, oh, well, this is how a social psychologist would think about that. I developed a theory, came back, and for the next 14 years, I did research on that, and I was identified as an alcohol researcher, addictive behaviors researcher, and it was a lot of fun, but that too had politics.
Yeah. And this was totally a non-racial...
Nothing to do with race whatsoever. I've worked on three major research projects in my life, three major idea, so to speak, and one of them is race, but the other two have not been, the self and addictive behaviors.
It's kind of ironic that you say there's not as much politicizing of the work as you would expect, because in this period of time specifically, it seems like science is being so politicized, or at least it's being written about that it is. A lot of people have the feeling that it is, and you would think that it'd be the opposite, that the hard physical sciences are sort of more immune to that. But maybe because you're dealing with human beings, something in that makes it a little more difficult.
You're saying the physical sciences are not immune to politics, or that they do seem to be more immune to politics?
Well, you would think so, but right now there's so much going on where they're, say, the results of a certain study are being used for political means.
Yes, right.
And there are a lot of special interest groups that want this result versus that versus the other, which I'm sure is across the board in all fields to some degree, but right now it seems to be very charged in the physical sciences and the, I guess, the biological sciences as
That's interesting. It's sort of comforting to think that, you know, it's not just happening to you. But that's true. That does happen to our research occasionally, at least, and maybe more than I know, because it's hard to even know what people are saying about you sometimes. But that's exactly what happens, is that you say something that either one side really likes and wants to use it against the other side, or you say something that the other side really hates and they attack you directly in some public forum or something. And I don't know what to do about it, but I've kind of gotten, well, you know, you go through the emotion of it whenever it happens.
I guess they have agendas and they assume you do, or they want to make it seem you do somewhere.
Yeah. I try real hard not to be formed by that. And I see some people being formed by that, and that's a negative example to me. You know, I'll show them. I'll do five studies that prove that they're wrong. And I don't want to, as best I can, get my science directed by that.
When you had started out doing experiments early on, you mentioned doing an experiment with fish and then on humans. Was there any kind of shift in your thinking? Was it a little bit frightening to go into humans as research subjects, or was that a natural segue?
I was probably so naive at the time, I didn't notice it that much. So it probably was not something I thought a lot about at that time. I took a course from Ralph Sabula in social psychology, and I knew, like the third day, that I wanted to do this forever. And so even though I enjoyed the animal work, and I enjoy all parts of psychology, I was a psychology junkie, I just loved it. I'd go to anything, and I still have that feeling for it. but I also knew where I loved to think, and it was at the social psychological level.
Sounds like you were already primed for it, so there was no problem.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I had Clark there as he was a social psychologist. I had him there as a model, and so I was off.
You did your master's work at Ohio State University?
Yeah.
What sorts of problems were you tackling there?
I think my graduate school experience is a testament to how much I loved the field because it was such boring work. I love my advisor, my academic advisor. He was absolutely critical to me staying in the field, and I say that about him much now because a lot of our work deals about, well, what is necessary, what kind of an environment is necessary for minorities and women to thrive in the sciences, and he was part of the environment that helped me do it, so I love him. But the work we did was utterly boring. It was on the measurement of attitudes, and we were, through much of my graduate career, doing careful scientific work to decide whether, if you divided an attitude scale, like a response scale, up into 9 units versus 3 units, would that affect how much attitude change people would display if you tried to persuade them along that dimension, that issue. So it was absolutely kind of tiny measurement issue about the techniques of measuring attitudes. And this was the zeitgeist of the era. And so to have survived that and still wanted to be a social psychologist was pretty amazing.
You got your fine-tuning skills together, too.
Yeah, so it taught me to be, a good methodologist and to love methodology, which I always have. I still teach it to this day, and it's one of my favorite courses to teach. But it was really boring work in graduate school.
Did you go straight to Stanford out of graduate school?
No, I've had an interesting ascendance through the academic world. My first job was at the University of Utah. I was there for 2 years, loved that. Then my next job was at the University of Washington in Seattle. I taught there for 14 years, and that's kind of that really was a formative period of my career. I went through the academic ranks there. And then I spent 4 years at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and that was an absolutely explosively good time for me, good place to be, the influences, the colleagues. And then I moved to Stanford, where I've now been for, I think this is the end of my 13th year. So,
what were you working on as you were going up through the ranks? Were you starting on the self-affirmation work at that point?
Well, because I wasn't taking up the problem that I'd done research on in graduate school, because as I just described, I didn't like it that much. I floundered trying to find a problem. And this is a classic way not to have an early career. I did things that were scattered on a whole bunch of topics. I could prove enough to my colleagues that I could do social psychology, that I got tenure, and I could get grants and things, but I really didn't have problems. So it was after I had tenure that I thought, I've really got to get a programmatic thing here. And so I sat down and developed some ideas that did lead to self-affirmation, and at the same time I developed some ideas that led to our research on addictive behaviors and alcohol addiction. So those two things started pretty early in my career, but maybe just before I got in tenure, I kind of had the seeds of those two lines of research.
Were you doing experiments at that point also?
Yes. In the work that became what we now call self-affirmation theory, I just got interested in cognitive dissonance as a phenomenon. It was a classic problem in the field. People were doing these elegant experiments that, again, I loved them just because they were so elegant. Mark Zanna and Joel Cooper at Princeton had done these really beautiful experiments. And so I said, I'd like to do those. So I just started doing them and getting some students to play with some ideas. And so we found something that became the core of that work, which was that dissonance has a basic assumption about the human psyche, which is that you can't stand psychological inconsistency. So the idea is that it always bugs us and that it hounds us until somehow or another we rationalize our way out of it. That's what cognitive dissonance theory is about.
So what would an example of that be?
Let's see that you found yourself, saying, I'm very much for John Kerry. But in another group later in the day, you found yourself advocating a position which you know he opposes. There's a psychological inconsistency. And according to the theory, that's going to bug you. And you're going to do some thinking to make that fit somehow. So you could say, well, I like John Kerry, but he's wrong on this, and this is important, but I'm going to still vote for him because these other issues are important. So now you're out of the inconsistency with that. This is not a political conversation,
right, no.
But just an example.
Exactly.
And the idea is that drives mental life. It's a very ambitious theory. That's one of the beauties of it. It drives our psychological mental life, this need for this consistency, and that we're basically all day long rationalizing, thinking human beings. There's at a subconscious level, and sometimes quite conscious, an effort to explain everything. So I dial a telephone number to get you on the phone, and you're not there. And a little voice in my head starts to say, well, okay, it's okay that she's not there. Actually, I'm going to get this other memo written, and that was a lot better anyway. And I'm really a good person and a competent. And then all day we're constantly sustaining, that's how a self is maintained and constructed. So that last sentence there about a self being maintained and constructed, that was our idea. Their idea was that it's basically a consistency notion. We showed that it was about the self being constructed, that the whole motive of this thing wasn't about inconsistency, that people really don't care about inconsistency. What they're really concerned about is maintaining a self, an image of the self as good and competent, morally adequate, all those. That's the primary human concern that drives mental life. And the way we showed that experimentally is that we would have people behave in an inconsistent way and then give them something that would affirm the self, a value of theirs that they could endorse, that we knew we'd pre-selected them for having this particular value. And it wouldn't do anything to resolve this inconsistency they just had. But if we allowed them to affirm that sense of themselves, we found they could completely tolerate that inconsistency. And that was the heart of our insight, that they could just, that people can tolerate inconsistency all the time if we're reminded of something that's more important to me. So that Kerry example of, I could rationalize about the particular cognitions involved, Kerry and the issue that I contradicted him with. I could worry that through, or I could simply step aside and say, well, look, I'm a good parent and a good scientist. And if you reminded me of those things, I would say, yes, I'd admit that I was inconsistent there and wouldn't try to rationalize it.
Well, this brings up a lot of different areas you could look at. This whole theory seems to be about how we're able to live with ourselves,
yeah,
more or less. So is this a sort of plastic process, or is it very consistent throughout the individual's lifespan, how they handle this? Is this built in a consistent manner?
It's interesting. Other people have been more interested in individual differences in this, I'll call it self-maintenance process, maintaining a self-image. And again, what we're saying is going on is that the sense we have of ourselves, of being good and competent people, takes a lot of work. It's maintained on a daily basis of thinking and explaining ourselves to the world and ourselves to ourselves in ways that make ourselves feel competent, coherent, having a single identity. When those things break down, the personalities get split, and all kinds of problems happen. So the effort involved in maintaining a coherent sense of self and identity is an ongoing process, and that's what a lot of internal dialogue all day is about. That's what Zen meditation would have us stop for a moment. Can you take a break from that?
probably healthy
to take a break from that. And for all of us, at some points of our lives, we get threatened. It gets feverish, this effort to maintain this, to restore this sense. Somebody breaks up with us. You get fired. Somebody doesn't like that, you get a paper rejected. These are moments where the effort, you see that system vividly at work, because the effort is to get back to a self that is good, competent, reasonable, and so on. And I think the byproduct of that, if I can call it, it's probably better to call it the main product of all that effort, is adaptation to life. If you take drugs and you interfere with that, which you can do, then people don't adapt to life as well. You know, sometimes that gets so feverish, a drug is useful, an antidepressant or something, to bring that down so that they can get a more reasonable grasp of things. But if you stunt that altogether with an addiction, let's say, you just don't develop, and people don't adapt well. And that's one of the big symptoms of drug addiction, is that people are not functioning in their lives very well. And it's in part because it's interfered with this basic energy we have to think about the world and ourselves and to figure it out and to maintain this our own standards of the kind of person we want to be. So it's that's central to what I think a human being is. And we were kind of working on this at the level of a variety of arguing with cognitive dissonance theory and several other versions of cognitive dissonance theory to kind of clarify what the basic process is. They were arguing it's all about a need for consistency. We were arguing, no, it's about this need to construct this ongoing sense of oneself, maintain this sense of oneself. And we were doing experiments to, well, if it's what you say, this should happen. If it's what I say, this should happen. So that's a lot of fun when science gets to that point, where these questions that you have are actually answerable, or at least we have the sense that they're answerable with these kind of experiments.
And I guess you can't really say there's an ideal way, or maybe you can, but I would imagine an ideal way is to be able to evolve as you go along, but not too broadly.
Yeah, I see where you're leading me. You know, I wish I could say something better about that, because I can point to different ways in which this practices, styles in which people do this, that I think are very maladaptive, and some that are more adaptive. I can point to that. I think if you just don't have any recourse here, then this system runs away with itself very easily, and you get neurotic, and you can't have a sense of the next little issue is what the whole self is riding on. And that's not good. You have to have that's where some balance in life, several domains where you are deriving a sense of value are important. If you can imagine a teenager who's, I used to use this example of a world-class tennis player who's 16, and there's nothing in their life but that. There's no relationships, there's no school achievements that are significant and gratifying, there's no anything else. Well, then the whole value of the self rides with every score, with every match. And that's a painful situation to be in. And it's hard for us to recognize that because we think, on the outside, my goodness, they're world champions, they're making a lot of money. But so much of their value is riding on that one thing. Whereas most adults are fortunate enough to have relationships and other domains of life and work. And so when things are going bad in one domain, we're deriving some value from another. And we can maintain some distance from those troubles in one domain, that having a self based on this other domain is giving us some distance like that. Now you can have too many things. You can be, you know, all these. This process can go awry in a number of ways.
But these can be choices on some level also, can't they? I mean, this person, the tennis player at 16, could say, this is how I motivate myself to win.
And oftentimes, I'm just old enough to have observed this fact that my son is a musician, and a lot of people are talented musicians. But the people who become musicians are often people who don't have any alternative, which is interesting to me. That I got to, at the conservatory, you just meet a lot of kids who are trying to be musicians, and it's really hard and competitive and difficult, and a lot of kids drop out because they can do other things, or they want to go find other things. But some kids, that's what they are. And that's as predictive of who's going to be a musician as the actual talent issue at a given point in time.
Your research on alcohol addiction kind of came out of what you were just discussing then, about a way of avoiding or not dealing with...
Well, yes and no. One of the studies we did do was to show that drinking, just like affirming the self, would dissolve the worry about inconsistency. Drinking will dissolve the worry about inconsistency. And we were making the argument there for that's how drinking gets to be addictive, that I drink and then the inconsistencies of the day fade away, and I'm reinforced by that. And so I begin to associate drinking with the dissolving of those inconsistencies and those problems. And so I pretty soon I've learned now to use drinking as a means of regulating the self like that. And it becomes addictive in a core way like that. And then I start to get a physiological accommodation of alcohol, the toxin in alcohol, because my body is now adjusted to my use of this substance, and I start to need more of that substance to get the same self-regulatory benefit, and now I'm really on my way to alcoholism. So we were telling a story like that, that the drugs are used to regulate this process. That's one story we told, and I don't think that ever got quite as developed as I would like to have seen it, because I think it's an important description of how things get to be addictive. But the other one was a much more, was unrelated to all of that. That was a simple idea that alcohol impairs our cognitive, our ability to think, our ability to perceive, and in particular our ability to foresee, to see the consequences of things. We just can't think that far ahead. And yet, it doesn't impair very much our ability to just immediately apprehend and take in stimulation. So it we think about it as a psychologist, it creates this distinctive frame of mind. And we said, well, if that's true about what alcohol does to this frame of mind, when will it have effects on behavior and emotion? So we started with a very simple idea that when behavior is under conflict, whereas if I was sober, I would really want to do something at the same time that I'd really be afraid to do it, then alcohol is going to interfere with that fear. Because the fear, I have to be able to see a little bit in the future, to see that if I do this, this consequence will happen. Or I'll violate a personal norm of my own. I have to be able to see that. And alcohol is blocking my ability to see that. So in that situation, where there's conflict, I want to do something real bad, and at the same time, if I'm sober, I can see these consequences. Alcohol whacks away the consequence side and just frees the impulse. And so in that high conflict situation, I'm really impulsive. Aggression. Somebody insults me at a bar, and the guy is much bigger than me. And if I'm sober, I can recognize that A, he's a lot bigger than me, B, I don't like to be involved in violence anyway, it's against my moral standards and all that sort of thing. But if I'm intoxicated, I can't really see that. I can't see the consequences. I can just experience the insult that he's made of me. And I respond to that. I mean, just react. And therefore, I'm much more aggressive under that situation. However, alcohol should have no effect if the situation is different. If when I'm sober, there wouldn't be any conflict. There's no negative consequences, or there's a very weak impulse to be aggressive. He hasn't insulted me or anything. It's not going to, and this is what people don't quite get about alcohol. They think it will, or any drug, that it has the power to always produce a behavior. And we're trying to describe the precise situation under which it will produce a behavior in which it won't. If you're not stimulated to be aggressive, then drinking will not make you be aggressive. If there are no consequences against you being aggressive, then when you're intoxicated, you won't be any more aggressive than you would have otherwise, even if you are intoxicated. So that was our logic, and we did this. We tested it, and again, this is the fun of the science part. We tested it in experiments where we looked at helping behavior as opposed to looking at aggression. So the person would be either intoxicated or not. Then they would have done a very boring task, like cross out the A's and E's in a paragraph of legal prose. Deadly boring. And they're, you know, like they're doing pages of these. Then an experimenter comes up to them and says, this is from my dissertation. Now, you've done all you need to do for the experiment, but would you help me by doing some more? How many more would you do? Well, if they're intoxicated, our feeling is they'd be a lot more helpful there than if they were sober. And the reason they would be a lot more helpful is because they can't, when they're intoxicated, foresee how horrible doing another batch of these things would be. So that they'll just say, sure, I'll help you. And they'll just, yeah, give me 10 more. And sure enough, that's what happened. And in the other condition, where they weren't intoxicated, of course, they don't do very many because they can, you know, they see that this is a horrible task. They say, thank you very much, and they're out of there somehow or another. So we were getting at this, the role of conflict in mediating this thing, or in a low conflict situation where the guy said, would you do some more? They're intoxicated. But he says, would you do some more of these? You know, there's an undergraduate down the hall, and he would like you to help him by doing some more. So very little impulse to do it. Then intoxicated subjects don't do any more than non-intoxicated subjects. So we're getting at that process and trying to figure out how does this thing actually cause drunken excess that is such a completely important, such an amazingly important problem in society, this business of, I mean, alcohol is involved in most of the murders, most of the car accidents, most of the violent crime, violence that our society has, huge contribution to that. You know, 60-70% of those things happen when people are intoxicated on alcohol, specifically on alcohol.
It must be difficult to account for certain factors like people who've had something very horrible happen just recently. I mean, I'm not sure how you set up the experiments, but there's some people who would be just more positive people to begin with. Maybe they're the happy drunks, the quote-unquote happy drunks. Mm-hmm. I don't know. How do you take all these different factors of individuals or mm-hmm. personalities into account? Or is it just a statistical?
Yeah, it's a great methodological question. And the way you do it is to randomly assign people to conditions, to the experimental condition and to the control condition. So presumably you've got just as many people who have one kind of reaction to alcohol in one condition as you do to another. So you've essentially equated the two conditions for these individual differences in response to the drug or something like that. Now when you're comparing the two, one's under high conflict and one's under low, the main thing that can cause a difference between those two groups of people in responding to alcohol is this conflict variable. So you're kind of in an experiment, in order to look at the effect of one cause, you're holding all the other causes constant. And there are standard ways of doing that. You can randomly assign people, so you by chance you've got you can assume you've got as many people of one kind and another as another kind in each condition, or you can carefully match them on some things that you think are if there really is a individual difference reaction to alcohol that you know about, you can measure that and put just as many in one condition who have that as you have in the other, and so you work on it that way.
And I guess you have to take into account there might be some actual alcoholics in these mixes too.
Well, we try to, in those days, we try to screen those people out as much as possible, so that the human subjects protocols for running subjects through these alcohol experiments was very, very involved. Careful screening so that you didn't get as much as you could assure. They'd have to sign consent forms and indicate that they're not alcohol addicted or diagnosed as alcoholics, even to the point of giving pregnancy tests to people who showed up.
Because they'd be drinking,
yeah. Then you have to get their blood alcohol level. You have to get them drunk and keep them there until you get them sober.
That must have been fun.
There's a lot of work. It can take 4 or 5 hours to run a subject, one single subject through an experiment.
Boy, almost as bad as sleep research.
Yeah.
Did you have to read a lot or take into account a lot of the physiological studies done with alcohol and addiction, or
yeah.
were you able to do it without that?
No, you had to really know that stuff, and I was fortunate to be, this was done when I was at the University of Washington in Seattle, and a lot of people in that psychology department did this kind of research, so I was in a community of scientists that knew a lot about that, and we had a graduate program in addictive behaviors, and there were 4 faculty involved, a clinical psychologist, 2 physiological psychologists, and me, a social psychologist. So I had at my fingertips people who were more expert in that, and I learned an awful lot from them, and then my students learned a lot from them. So you really do have to, when you're doing research on a problem like that, addictive behaviors or alcohol addiction, you have to really learn stuff outside your own field so that you will have an informed approach to the problem itself.
People often use alcohol to self-medicate. Is that effective?
It can be. And this is where I should say a couple things. I think that in background to our research, I think there are people who have brain chemistries or body chemistries, and I'm using that term without being able to unpack it very knowledgeably, but who use it in reaction to certain tendencies of their own system to metabolize alcohol, and they get a benefit out of it. So that there's sometimes, I think there is a direct individual body chemistry that these drugs can affect. That's not the way we were studying it. We were trying to get, for most people, independent of having a particular body chemistry that would make the drug effective with regard to reducing anxiety or medicating away depression. When does that happen? Because when you look at the research literature, the surprising thing is that it doesn't always seem to reduce people's depression. Half the studies show it did, half the studies show it didn't. And again, our task was to find out when it did and when it didn't. And we started with the same assumption I just described, that alcohol would interfere with your sort of ability to think and to foresee the consequences of your behavior and so on. So we came up with the following notion: that alcohol would reduce your anxiety and your depression if you were also doing something else when you were drinking, and that it wouldn't if you were doing nothing else but drinking. and by something else, I mean many of the things that commonly go with drinking, like talking to other people at a party or at a bar or even in your house, then alcohol, what it's going to do is narrow your window of attention and perception and cognition, thinking. Your mental functioning is going to be narrowed to what's right in front of you. And if what's right in front of you is a nice, friendly other person, even a book to read, Hemingway used to drink in order to read, it will help that. And you'll freeze out the daily worries that have been bothering you and intruding on your thinking. You know, the argument with the boss and the replaying of it and the rumination that goes along with that. That gets frozen out because now you've got a chemical which is restricting your attention to what's right in front of you. And it produces that kind of focalism which relieves the anxiety. So it's an indirect effect. But its ability to relieve anxiety or depression is that it's closing out the thoughts in conjunction with some activity. The two things together are closing out the thoughts that would otherwise be disturbing. But if you have those thoughts, you come home and you had an argument with your boss, and you have nothing to do, and you pour a drink, and you sit at your table, you could wind up crying in your beer. It could backfire, and this happens a lot with the elderly. They say, oh, my daughter is not called, and because they're not doing anything else. If they'd go to a baseball game or even turn on the television, they'd get this relief. So that is a way of explaining how it gets addictive, because the alcohol, people thought, well, it has these direct antidepressive effects or it has direct anti-anxiety effects. It doesn't have direct. It can make both things worse unless you're doing something else. It only primarily interferes with your thinking and narrows your window of perception and thought. And if you fill that little narrow window with some other activity, then you'll freeze out the distracting thoughts, the troubling thoughts. But otherwise, if you don't accompany it with the activity, it'll just focus you on those distracting, disturbing thoughts, and you'll cry in your beer.
So basically, it more or less allows you to be distracted, whether it be distracted
That's right.
by your bad thoughts or distracted from the bad thoughts by a person or
yeah,
television.
That's right. So that's why, like, maybe a glass and a half of wine or a glass, depending on what your tolerance for alcohol is, maybe a wine, will enable you to read a book, you know, focus on that for a while. Because it's clothes freezing out the things that make you get up and say, oh, I need to do the laundry, I need to do this, I need to do that. And so that's how it kind of gets into a normal person's, again, self-regulation and gets addictive. Because anytime you take a toxin in like that, your body learns to cope with it. It sees it coming, and it says, this is the physiological side of it, it says, uh-oh, here it comes, I'm going to get ready for it, and it gets ready for it. And because it can cope with it, you start to need more and more of it to get some of the same effects. And then you get to a point where the body sees it coming, and if you don't give it to the body goes into withdrawals because it starts to accommodate for something that isn't there. Then you know you're addicted. You know, people have coffee addictions in a pretty regular way where they don't have the coffee, you get a headache, and because you're in a situation where the cues are telling you, this person's supposed to be giving me coffee and they're not giving me coffee, and I'm all ready for it.
Yeah, and your blood vessels are...
Yeah, you're constricting, getting ready for it, you know, and you haven't given it, so it's like... That's how a lot of overdoses happen. That they don't happen from people using a lot more drugs. They happen from an addict who is taking the drug in a place where they don't normally take it. They normally take it in their apartment or in a club or on the street. And here they are at home in their mother's house for Thanksgiving. And the cues are not telling the body, get ready for the drug. And they go into the bathroom and they shoot up the normal amount of drug that they have. And the body is not ready for that. And they just, boom, they overdose.
Obviously, there's a physiological reason that people get addicted, but is it possible for people to be addicted solely on a non-physiological? And the way they say, I guess, marijuana is not really physically addictive. Can one have that with alcohol also, not really have the biochemical response that the classic alcoholic has, but still become an alcoholic just from these social...
Well, I think by the time you're an alcoholic, and part of what the definition means is that you really need it to function, I think it always, even with marijuana or any toxin, involves that process I just described. Tolerance is what it's called. As soon as you develop tolerance for the drug, then you've got a mild addiction. Most social drinkers have a mild addiction in the sense that they drink 2 glasses of wine at dinner. That doesn't sound like a lot, maybe. But when they started out, they couldn't do that without really getting pretty intoxicated. Maybe a half a glass of wine. Or if they stay away from it for 3 weeks, then they have a half a glass of wine, they really get a buzz out of that. But if they've been drinking regularly, they take a half a glass of wine and they don't feel anything. That's tolerance. The body is learning how to do this. So if you, in part, a good drinker, somebody can drink a lot, is somebody that's been drinking a lot. So I think it always involves that. If you just drink a glass of wine every night, you're going to have a little tiny bit of tolerance because that glass of wine is not going to disorient you very much. Your body's learned to accommodate that toxin and keep you oriented at the same time. But nonetheless, there is a little tolerance there. That if that process is increased by you taking in more and more wine, it's going to be something we call an addiction.
You were doing most of this work while you were at University of Washington?
Yes.
And then you moved
to Michigan.
Were you carrying this work on still in Michigan?
No, I tried to, but several things happened. This is a problem that's in clinical psychology, addictive behaviors, not in social. And when I moved to Michigan, I didn't have clinical students like I had at Washington. And so I didn't have students that were invested in it. If you were a social psychologist, you started doing alcohol research, people wouldn't hire you. So the students weren't interested in doing this. That was an issue, and the human subjects giving pregnancy tests to every woman who you run, you need maybe 120 subjects, participants, for every study. It's got to be a huge hassle. And I kind of answered the questions I was most interested in. It was a problem I enjoyed immensely, but it wasn't, I was kind of satisfied by that point.
It's kind of a sidetrack from what you were originally on.
Yeah, that's right. And I kind of had done that and followed through. And so at Michigan, when I moved there, I wrote up the paper, some of the overview papers, but I didn't really do any more alcohol research.
So what? How do you decide where to go from there then?
Well, when I got there, it was a completely rejuvenating experience because I was initially asked to direct a minority achievement program. And I came and interviewed and looked at the program and saw some interesting facts that interested me as a social psychologist, but I didn't want to direct that program, so I turned the job down. And I went back to Washington and lived another year there, and then Michigan said, well, please come, and we don't care about whether you do that program. And Michigan has it's been the leading social psychology program in the field, or among the 1, 2, or 3 best forever. So we moved to Michigan. So I was intellectually interested in the minority program that I'd seen, but I didn't want to administer it. And so I turned it into an intellectual problem, and I just started thinking about it. The single fact that really captured my scientific interest was, I told you about my past, and so now you know the long stream of interest there that was just waiting to be reignited. And what reignited them was this discovery, or this handout in one of the committee meetings, showing that at every level of entering SAT scores or ACT scores, the black students at Michigan were getting lower grades than the white students. And the thing that's puzzling about that is that I had thought there is a grade gap between black and white kids at all colleges, virtually all of them. And I thought that was maybe due to differences in preparation that African Americans don't have. I've learned, same access, same educational resources. And so when you get way down the line at a strong university like that, maybe the black students don't have the same preparation as a group, as the white students. And so that could explain a gap. But this by definition meant that wasn't the full explanation, because here they are with exactly the same SAT scores and high school grades, and they came into Michigan with exactly the same preparation as measured by these classic measures. And yet at 1,100 SATs, 1,300 SATs, 1,000 SATs, very few kids at Michigan with that, but at each of those levels, the black kids were getting lower grades. So that meant something else was going on. And that turned out to be lawful in the United States. It turns out to be lawful with regard to women in advanced math and quantitative areas. So I thought we had a basic fact that would be really interesting to understand from the standpoint of a social psychologist. So I kind of stopped everything and just started thinking about that when I got to Michigan. So Michigan was really a kind of watershed.
So the objective facts were all the same there, but the subjective experience was what was creating this gap.
Right. I did know what it was, and I wanted to know what it was. What could that be? It's just a huge mystery. This is just what you really want as a scientist, is to somebody to put in your lap a mystery like that. This is important to society. I mean, the United States has at least a vision and an explicit value of having an integrated society, gender-wise, ethnicity-wise, racial-wise. And here's something that is threatening that something is going on which is depressing the grades and achievement levels of these groups. So now I think I have at least part of the explanation for that. I'm not sure we yet have a total explanation, but we have a very simple theory, but a very long program of research now, 15 years later, to give an answer to that problem. But it's that problem that started.
You developed this theory of self-image threat?
Yes. The self-affirmation work is where we developed the notion that one of the things a person has to deal with is self-image threat on a daily basis. And that's where these rationalizations come from. And that's what's upsetting about an inconsistency, is that it threatens this image of me being a real competent person. So that's a threat to this image of the self. And so I struggle to resolve that. And in the case of these groups, this underperformance is the name of that phenomenon, where they're getting lower grades at every level of preparation as measured by SATs. That's called underperformance, because they should be performing at the same level as whites, but they're underperforming, or men in the case of women. That underperformance we would explain as a threat coming from stereotypes about their group, and threats coming from their identities, threats in the air, so to speak. So yes, there's this sort of basic connection between that earlier research.
The stereotype threat, it's not that they necessarily buy into the stereotype, but that they realize that there is one, and that's making them be less focused or too focused in some cases?
Exactly. That's exactly the case, that if I'm doing something for which the stereotype is relevant, then I can experience this threat that I'm going to be, I can be judged or treated here in terms of how people think about my group. And I don't like that. And so right there in the situation, I could be distracted enough to underperform, to cause me to not perform as well. And over time, I might find that whole situation, a whole struggle of resisting the stereotype, disproving it, and the whole hassle involved with that. I could say, there must be some other domain of life where I'm going to just be more comfortable. You know, I've put that in explicit terms. That's experience at a largely unconscious level, I think. But that's the logic of it, that pressure, where you're constantly under this stereotype pressure in a competitive domain, like academic performance, for example, is wearing on people. It can lead them to find another domain of life where their group is not negatively stereotyped and just feel instantly more comfortable and psychologically free.
I'm guessing that, as with most areas, individual differences can make a difference. There must be people who maybe they're contrarian, so they're going to actually do well because of this, but they would be very rare instances.
No, I think they are not rare, and I think that's the primary motive by which this underperformance is happening. It's that it's an interesting thing in life, but they're trying too hard in these domains where their group is stereotyped negatively, yet they know that this domain is important. A woman in math, let's say, it's an important domain. She loves it. She's good at it. But as she gets toward her sophomore, junior year of college, there just aren't many women around. And at some level or another, she starts to worry about being a woman. Whether sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's barely conscious. But she's bound and determined not to let that bug her. On the test, in the conversations with other students, in the conversations with professors, she's not going to let that get to her. She will change how she dresses. She'll change her values. She'll do a variety of things in order to make it there in this important domain. And that's where the problem comes in, is that the attempt to disprove the stereotype, to be the contrarian, because everybody thinks they are, but they all are doing the same thing, that effort itself gets to be tiring, and women you know, kind of leave those fields in massive numbers as those years go by. In a society where the stereotypes are different, like in Poland, we did some research early on. Not so, because women are half the engineers and they're half of the physicists. So there isn't in that society the same evidence on which you could base a stereotype that there is here. So as women go up the math ladder there, they're not in a more exclusively male world. And they don't feel this pressure about their gender and whether it's accepted and whether they have the, you know, it has the ability to compete and whether they'll be seen at every time they ask the wrong question in class or they get to the difficult part of an exam. They don't have that worry. And so they go on, they're kind of relaxed. And they come to the United States and they wonder, what's all this stuff about women in math?
I guess there's also that perceived weight of responsibility of being the woman that has
to
be.
Yeah, and there's that. You know, you don't let your group down. And so that's where the effort is coming from, like in our experiments on standardized tests. Again, the fun of being a scientist here is that you can take a general question like that and boil it down to something where you can get a test of it. So we give women and men, we find them who are really good in math, dedicated to it, give them a real hard test, and find that the women at the frontier of their skills, find that women don't do as well as the men. For women, our argument is basically it's a completely different situation taking that test. The test is the same, the proctor is the same, the room's the same, the items, but for a woman, when she's frustrated, that gives credence to this stereotype and its applicability to her, or that somebody's going to see her that way. And that expands the emotion. It says, like, well, maybe you don't belong here. Whereas for the man, that's not going on. The frustration is like, maybe it's signaling that he particularly, as an individual, isn't that good. But it's not. He's not at risk of confirming anything about being a man, any limitation that men have. So even though all those things are the same, this is a very different psychological situation for the two people. And that's what's causing it. So the way we demonstrate that is to find this underperformance on the part of women and get rid of it by taking the stereotype threat out of the situation. And the way you do that is to simply make the same test irrelevant to the stereotype about women in math. So you could do it by saying, this isn't a test of ability, this is a puzzle. Do the best you can. Represent it as a puzzle, women's performance goes way up to match that of men who have the same skills. Same test. So that tells us that what was repressing performance in that first test is this weight of the stereotype, because that's the only thing we took out of the situation in this kind of experimental design. You take it out of the situation, their performance goes up. So then you think about the real world. And in the real world, women can't take that pressure out of the situation on a difficult math test. They can try to beat it, which is exactly what these women were doing in this experiment. They were not giving up. They were rereading the items. They were changing their answers. Their blood pressure is elevated. Their short-term memory is impaired. All these things are going on that are not going on for men. They're interfering with their performance there. Now the field has done, there are hundreds of these studies that are published on all kinds of groups that show the same kinds of effects.
It seems like the same kind of mechanism you would say for just a person that's a bad test taker.
Yeah, very similar. Because you could imagine somebody who's a pretty smart person, but they're following an older sib who's a genius through school or something, right? So they get on that test and they start to be frustrated and they say, oh God, this just confirms that. You know, some quiet, disturbing voice says, oh my God, I'm just not as smart as Sarah ever was. And this proves it. And so they're worried with all that, right? And yet it's kind of, the interesting other thing we're finding is that this is kind of unconscious for people, so they're not able to label it. And so they just think, I'm a bad test taker.
When you articulate it, it seems sort of like an obvious thing, and
yeah.
Something that should have been taken into account in the education system, but
yeah.
It hasn't.
It hasn't, and all kinds of vested interests are opposed to it.
You mentioned before, though, you're taking these kids, black, white kids that have the same SATs. Why would it be different in high school than in college?
I wouldn't say that stereotype threat has not affected their SAT scores. Mm-hmm. It may well have affected their SAT scores. But in the experiment, we're interested in comparing groups. So
you're
it doesn't
selecting the kids that have the same.
Yeah. So this has gotten to be an issue around whether this explains the race gap in test performance. But our experiments are designed really not so much to address that. It's just to show the effect of stereotype threat it's being there versus it's not being there on their test performance. And basically what we show is that it affects the performance of blacks, the group whose abilities are negatively stereotyped there, but wouldn't affect the performance of whites. That's really all we can say with a single experiment like that. So it could be that those high school, when they were in high school, the stereotypes had also repressed the blacks' scores, and that we're bringing in blacks whose scores are actually higher than the scores that they have, if that had happened earlier. But that would just mean they're both groups, their pattern of means would be a little bit higher. It doesn't really invalidate the comparison we're after, which is the comparison of whether how well they perform under stereotype threat versus under no stereotype threat. That's the comparison we're after.
You're working at the scientific level, but of course there's an enormous amount of political storm around this type of issue, and this particular issue. And how do you feel about your research playing into certain
You're getting right at the, you know, the thing that does give me distress to some degree, although I think I'm getting better at handling it. So, but boy, I mean, it's been used by the right and it's been used by the left, and I suppose it's going to continue to be characterized in one way or another for these different purposes. On the particular question of whether it justifies single-sex or single-race education, I think there's genuine ambivalence. I'm a person who comes at this hoping that we can find a way to have integrated classrooms. And so after stereotype threat, that era of research, I would say most of our research now is on, well, how do you actually have an integrated classroom that works for everybody?
How do you remove the...
Yeah, how do you move the threat? Because we can do it in experiments, and then we can do it in classrooms somehow. We just have to figure out how to elaborate that, and that's exactly where our research is. So our mission is to, before we make the concession, to try to figure it out, that this may be at some level approachable.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.